they did exactly what they're trained to do. They methodically went through the checklist. What went wrong after that, the investigators will look very carefully at.
Search and recovery continues for a downed Indonesian passenger jet. It's Wednesday, October 31st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Sri Lanka politics in turmoil. Cambodians share their U.S. election voices. New products coming to China. A young scientist targets cancer. And a Halloween haunted house. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Indonesian divers have resumed the search for the cockpit recorders so investigators can determine why Lion Air Flight JT610 crashed into the Java Sea Monday as the pilot tried to return to Jakarta Airport shortly after takeoff. All 189 people on board are presumed dead. Only debris and body parts have been found and removed for identification. Contact with the Boeing 737 MAX 8 was lost 13 minutes after it lifted off on its way to Pangkal Pinang. The crash site is about 15 kilometers from shore, in water up to 35 meters deep. Investigators are trying to figure out why the pilot radioed for permission to return to the airport. There was no distress signal. The chief of Lion Air Group said the plane suffered a technical problem on a previous flight from Bali to Jakarta on Sunday, but it had been resolved according to procedure. John Cox, CEO of the Washington-based Safety Operating Systems Aviation Consultancy, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the crash and the Boeing 737, a widely used aircraft that has been constantly upgraded and improved since the 1960s.
So this is a proven airframe. It's a proven workhorse, and this is the most modern, up-to-date electronics, computers, and engines, the most fuel-efficient model of the 737. So it has quite a lengthy history that investigators will, of course, look at. The area around Indonesia in general can be very challenging in that there are mountains and some of the islands are pretty remote. It has beautiful resorts such as Bali. It has not got the most extensive infrastructure system, so it can be a challenging area for pilots. But fortunately, the newer generation airplanes, such as the 737 MAX 8, have got onboard flight computers that make the job of navigating a good bit simpler.
Well, John, the weather apparently was not a factor. It was clear at takeoff. Data from Flight Radar 24 showed the first sign of something amiss about 2 minutes into the flight when the plane reached about 2,000 feet or 600 meters. It descended more than 150 meters, veered to the left before climbing again, where it stayed during most of the rest of the flight. Does that give you any clues?
The first thing is, as an accident investigator, you have to really validate the data. So the initial raw data says that the airplane descended. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We need to validate those data points. But there is indication that it climbed to 5,000 feet, and that would be normal if the crew were having some type of abnormality. That's a good altitude. You're well away from the ground, and it gives you an opportunity to go through the checklist, to do the problem solving necessary. They determined that they wanted to return back to Jakarta. They didn't declare an emergency, which all of this says that they were handling the situation. They didn't feel that they were in imminent danger, and they did exactly what they're trained to do. They methodically went through the checklist. What went wrong after that, and the investigators will look very carefully at, but those answers we don't have yet.
The aircraft, after the ascent and the turnaround, began actually gaining speed in the final moments, reaching 345 knots before data was lost when it was at about 1,100 meters. Does that give you any further clues, or we're just going to have to wait for the black boxes to be recovered?
First, the recorders will tell us the entire story. But the limited data that we have, one of the things that struck me was, why is the speed so high? And if, in fact, that turns out to be true, then that will help the investigators understand that whatever was wrong in those last, say, 20 seconds of the flight, something appears to be terribly wrong here. And the investigators are going to look for what could possibly have caused such a very rapid descent rate at such a high speed.
John Cox said the Indonesian aviation industry has been reviewed carefully by the European Union and U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, which withdrew their authority to fly. He said Lion Air, a relatively new carrier, had upgraded its safety protocols to allow it to fly in European airspace. Cox said it is too early to draw any conclusions about whether flight JT610 was the victim of a systematic problem in Indonesian aviation. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now on VOANews.com. Bangladesh and Myanmar agree to repatriate Rohingya. Typhoon YouTube batters Philippines. Just a little wobble, thousands feel 6.1 magnitude quake in New Zealand. Conservationists alarmed as China eases ban on tiger and rhino parts. U.S. restricts exports to Chinese semiconductor firm. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia, also the VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. In Sri Lanka Tuesday, a warning from the Parliament Speaker of street violence unless Parliament is allowed to choose one of two rival prime ministers in a political dispute that was sparked by President Maithripala Sirisena's decision to sack the prime minister and replace him with former President Mahinda Rajapakse. The president also suspended Parliament. There is some question as to whether this is a power struggle between rivals India and China, which has growing influence since Rajapakse ushered in billions in Chinese investment to rebuild after a 26-year Tamil insurgency was defeated. RAND Corporation Director of Asia-Pacific Policy and Senior Economist Rafiq Dasani comments on whether New Delhi and Beijing played any part in this constitutional dispute.
Not directly. I don't think that China put Rajapaksa up to this, or that India put Vikramasinghe up to this. I think the problem is largely domestic, where Sirisena and Vikramasinghe, the president and the prime minister, have been increasingly at odds on domestic politics. And this might have to do with the reality that with elections about a year and a half away, they come from different parties and will be contending for power possibly at that time. So I think looking at that and looking at Rajapaksa's success in local elections earlier this year, where both the parties of Sirisena and that of Vikramasinghe lost heavily, I think precipitated this.
Mr. Rajapaksa has been close to Beijing, opening ports to Chinese vessels, which Dasani says has been happening historically.
Sri Lanka has always had, for many years, ports in Colombo have been built by China and by other parties, not Indian, but various groups, including Western groups and Chinese groups, have built ports in Sri Lanka very successfully. The issue is the Hambantota port, which I think you're referring to, which is in the south of the country and is a white elephant that China built at Rajapaksa's request and took on, and for which the country took on a debt of $1 billion. So that's something that remains unresolved in the sense that Sri Lanka then gave the port away to the Chinese in return for the debt. So the Chinese are now stuck with a white elephant, not quite sure what to do with it. And so that's what's creating the problem between them.
The Parliament Speaker warned the situation should be settled through the Parliament, but if not, he said it would be taken to the streets where there will be a huge bloodbath. Dasani does not agree that that would be the result.
Unfortunately, the situation in Sri Lanka is quite polarized right now, with Rajapaksa, who's much more hardline, having won in the local elections basically by raising fears about the right. He comes from a much more conservative, hardline background. And the basis on which he took charge and then successfully solved the Tamil insurgency, which was through hardline methods, are what people are fearing. And then when he was in power, he was a difficult prime minister, clamping down on the press and on freedoms generally. So I think people have memories of that, but at the same time, he won local elections. I think if he wins, if he comes into power, there won't be a bloodbath. People will give him a chance to prove his majority.
Rafiq Dasani said he is hopeful this dispute will be resolved peacefully. Ultimately, he said the removal of the prime minister must be validated by Parliament. Dasani cautioned Parliament's suspension until November 16th may have to be adjudicated before the country's Supreme Court. Happening now in Asia, former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has warned the government to expect a negative reaction from Indonesia if Australia follows the United States by shifting its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Turnbull is visiting Indonesia to discuss a bilateral free trade deal. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. During every election season, as many American citizens prepare to go to the polls, one group of immigrants has traditionally chosen not to get involved. The Cambodian community in the United States has been fearful of the government because of its past, but this midterm election is different. The largest Cambodian community in the U.S. is taking political action. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has their story from Long Beach, California.
This is a place of refuge for genocide survivors who are seeking peace.
I experienced extreme violence. I saw extreme violence where my mother was beaten to near death.
Demand your rights.
Laura Som founded the May Center to help survivors of the Cambodian genocide heal from the trauma of the Khmer Rouge's reign of terror. The communist regime killed roughly 2 million people. Here, students can take a civics class, a topic dear to Som, who says her father was murdered in Cambodia because he was against the government.
I spend my entire life, from then until now, to learn and heal myself so I could be civically involved, because I know that's the only way.
Som was teaching civics when her student V. Sarong asked the question that started a movement.
I asked the question of why Cambodian community doesn't have such political voice.
Members of the Cambodian community traditionally have not participated in local government or voted. The reason, says Charles Song, is fear.
Most of us didn't have a say back in our country because we live under so oppressive government that any say would probably end up with missing, you know, your brother and sister and all of that.
Cambodian Americans make up about 4% of the total population in Long Beach. More than half of them live in and near an area called Cambodiatown. This area is divided into four districts with four representatives. The Cambodian community has gathered thousands of signatures asking city officials to redraw district lines so Cambodiatown is consolidated into one district with one representative who understands its special needs.
We're people of the earth. We want plants and gardens. This is how we heal ourselves. But yet we are put into a community where it's a cement jungle.
Civil rights attorney Mark Coleman says other ethnic minority groups have succeeded at redistricting.
The Latino community did the same thing, and they created what more or less has been called a Latino district.
The Cambodian community is also supporting an item on the November ballot calling for an independent citizens group to redistrict the city after the 2020 census instead of having city officials draw the lines. Redistricting of the city will not be considered, said city officials, until after the 2020 census to get the most accurate population count. Song says he will keep fighting. He has survived much worse.
And that survival mode can only be used as a tool.
For many genocide survivors, this fight for representation is one step towards finding peace from their painful past. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Long Beach, California.
Coming up, new products are coming to China. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
The latest news from VOA Asia. A typhoon that has caused devastation in some western Pacific islands made landfall in the Philippines Tuesday, bringing strong winds and a risk of floods, storm surges, landslides in some northern provinces. U2, locally named Rosita, is the 18th typhoon to hit the Philippines this year. Much more on this and other stories are on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China's Import Expo is coming, while Japan and India move closer. These are the topics on this week's VOA Asia Business Scene, with Doug Bernard sitting in for Skylar Ogden.
Businesses around the world are getting ready for China's International Import Expo. The event will take place from November 5 to 10 in Shanghai and will attract more than 2,500 companies from dozens of countries. Chinta Kamdani, Deputy Chairperson, Indonesian Chamber of Commerce.
The opportunity like this is very important for us, in which China is making its first import expo. So targeted really for exporters from other countries who wants to export to China. So this is where we stand and we want to take this opportunity.
The expo was proposed by Xi Jinping at the Belt and Road Forum for International Cooperation in May 2017. He called it an important policy statement and action demonstrating China's embrace of greater openness. China-based companies will also be exhibiting. Thomas Owiansky, president, Audi China.
We're going to present our full range of particularly our most exciting premium cars we have in the Audi range. Our first electric SUV from Audi at this new exhibition.
Goods from foreign exhibitors continue to flood Shanghai customs as the event draws near. The 13th annual India-Japan summit took place this week, during which both countries agreed to step up their cooperation in areas of trade, defense, and business. Ties between India and Japan have blossomed as Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe increasingly see eye to eye, encountering growing Chinese assertiveness across Asia. At the summit, Abe and Modi agreed to joint military exercises, expanding ammunition sales, and strengthening defense ties. In areas of businesses, Abe pledged low-interest loans worth $2.8 billion for 7 infrastructure projects in India. For his part, Modi assured Japanese investors that all possible support would be given to them in expanding their business in India. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
I would like to invite all of you to speed up investment in India. I assure you that you will be given all possible assistance to help in strengthening trade relations between India and Japan.
Both countries agreed on the general importance of pursuing a free and open Indo-Pacific region. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Doug Bernard for Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, Myanmar and Bangladesh have agreed to repatriate Rohingya refugees back to the country they fled in the midst of a UN warning that genocide was still being committed against them. The date to begin repatriation is tentatively set for November 15th, with more than 5,000 refugees verified for return. Visit VOA Asia Facebook and return often. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, pancreatic cancer treatment could become more advanced with the help from a 13-year-old, Rishib Jain. He has created a tool for doctors to locate the hard-to-find pancreas more quickly and precisely during cancer treatment. VOA's Julie Tabo has learned the teen recently won a prestigious Young Scientist Award for his potentially game-changing idea.
Rishib Jain.
Rishib Jain from Portland, Oregon, recently won the Discovery Education 3M Young Scientist Challenge for creating an algorithm that uses artificial intelligence to improve pancreatic cancer treatments. He says during radiotherapy, his tool can find the pancreas faster and more precisely.
It's much harder to find the pancreas with the human eye, so even trained radiologists sometimes can take hours to locate where it is because of the amount of organs in the area, especially because the pancreas is hidden behind some of the other organs like the stomach, and it's right next to the spinal cord, which is right behind it, and that can have problems when doing surgeries and other treatments.
So he trained his tool, he says, on real CTE or MRI scans of the abdomen and the area so it could learn what the pancreas looks like and where it is located.
This is my tool, Pancreatic Cancer Deep Learning System in Action. On the right side here is a CT scan of a patient's abdomen. And throughout the different cycles of breathing and pancreas movement, it's hard to pinpoint the exact location of where it is. And on the left side is my artificial intelligence GUI prototype. So during MRI-guided radiotherapy treatment, doctors can use my tool to know exactly where the pancreas is. So then they can apply the radiation in a more like effective way so that errors for hitting other healthy cells or organs are reduced.
Pancreatic cancer is relatively rare, but usually fatal. It grows slowly, and since the pancreas is deep inside the body, early tumors often go undetected. People usually have no symptoms until the cancer has already spread to other organs.
I was able to solve this problem.
Jane plans to use his $25,000 prize money to develop his tool from a prototype into a workable model, and hopes to one day partner with hospitals and companies to commercialize it for public use. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Halloween has long been a popular holiday here in the United States and has become so across Asia. HauntedWorld.com estimates there are more than 4,000 Halloween fee-based attractions in the U.S., with the overall industry generating more than $1 billion. VOA's Joe Craig takes us on a behind-the-scenes tour of a popular haunted forest in Maryland, where people pay for a night of fright.
Disorienting. Creepy.
Would you like to be my friend?
Disturbing. But all part of the experience.
Hello, lovely. Welcome to Marcos Haunted Forest, where your deepest nightmares become true.
Creating these nightmares and making sure they are done safely is all part of Paul Brubacher's work at Markhoff's Haunted Forest in Dickerson, Maryland.
As an American population, we are very fortunate to live in relative safety 99% of the time. And I think we get complacent and we need to have that jostled in our bodies, so we're willing to pay money to go out and have somebody chase us around with a chainsaw.
The official season begins in October, but training begins earlier, when more than 200 actors and staff members reunite for the start of a new season.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for committing to the Haunted Forest and joining our family. We love it.
Then the acting coaches get to work, teaching actors the art of the scare.
Hey, keep them moving. I'm teaching you ways to keep them moving. Don't do it by yelling words like get out or boo.
Before nightfall, actors select the proper costumes and props. Then they head for the makeup artist's chair.
We have quite a tight system where we have 120 people filtering upstairs. And we basically have, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes per person, each artist. And hence why we use airbrushes, because any other method of trying to do this was just too slow.
And once the action starts, it doesn't stop until the last customer leaves.
We're on our feet for 8 hours, and we stay in character the entire time. We really strain our voice. We're talking. We're constantly using improv because we don't have scripts.
But actors say getting the scare makes everything worth it.
Did you see me?
When you're like a 5'5 small, you know, little girl, it's really fun to scare people who are huge, towering men.
As for the customers, they seem to enjoy it because they keep coming back year after year. Jill Craig, VOA News, Dickerson, Maryland.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. There's so many ways to hear our program, and one of our most fondest ways is on the radio. You can hear us on Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in today, and we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks go out to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Kelvin Fowler, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard. We welcome Keith Lane and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.